You're listening to KVMR FM, and tonight my special guest on the phone is Rex Garvin. Rex, thanks for joining me tonight.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Well, Rex, tell me where you grew up.
I grew up in Harlem, 122nd Street between 7th and 8th, three blocks from the immortal Apollo Theater.
Well, that was just right in the middle of everything, then.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
When was the first time you got interested in music?
Well, my mother gave me a piano. She had me do piano lessons. We had an old upright in the front room of the apartment. So I guess the first thing I saw, all I can remember is seeing this big thing in the front room. She didn't particularly like jazz or, well, R&B wasn't around then, but she didn't particularly like swing music. So she wanted her son to be more or less a rise above that. She couldn't stand it.
Mm.
She wanted me to rise above to learn to play classical music, you know, and, you know, it's one of those things where, okay, you know, what you going to do? You never talk back to your mom, you know. That's how I got interested in the music thing. And then, of course, we didn't have television when I was young. We had radio. So she would listen to the Hit Parade on the radio with Joe Stafford, Perry Como, and others like that.
So those were probably some of your first influences anyway, because that's some of the first music you heard.
Well, I heard a bunch of it because my neighbors was playing the good stuff. He was playing the Louis Jordan stuff, you know. And I listened to him and she couldn't stand it. But, you know, when you're living in that close proximity, you kind of said, oh, that's interesting. That's very interesting. And then something happened. During the radio, there was a program on WWRL on the radio called Dr. Jive. I forget the first Dr. Jive. It was Phil something, but then Tommy Smalls came along in the 50s. And, of course, most of the candy stores had jukeboxes. So after church, me and a bunch of us of kids would go to get a malted milk, which is almost not even heard of anymore. And we'd play this gigantic jukebox because at that time, the radios and the phonographs, they didn't have the bass sounds, but the jukebox always had those deep bass tones. And I think the name of the jukebox, I remember, was Rockola. Mm-hmm. It must have been a sign, you know. And then I heard the Hop Tone, Sunday Kind of Love, and I said, wow, that's, you know, it was just something that kids get together and play the jukebox, you know, and it just intrigued me. I felt an identification with that. Meanwhile, Miss Sanders, I lived in 224, and Miss Zell Sanders lived at 222. So therefore, she was getting together a group of girls called the Hearts. What she really wanted was a female ink spot. That's how that came to be.
Hmm.
And so she asked my mother that I heard Rexy play, you know, could he play for the group? She said, well, being that Miss Sanders was a security guard and a very big woman, not big, but very stout.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, no one said no to her. So being that it was in such close proximity, to, you know, she said it was okay. And then I got to co-mingle with these girls, and I was about 13, 14. And I said, okay, you know. See, I just started playing for the Hearts, and that's how it all got started, actually.
So you were playing piano on the Hearts records and...
Uh-huh. Two of them, you know. Because I don't remember that was so long ago, because I remember I used to play in the middle of the keyboard. Somehow or another, I found that sound to be quite interesting. But if you notice, every record back then had the treble, had the pick, 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 up in the higher keys.
Right.
I guess it recorded better, because those recording techniques were ancient, basically. So you had to get the sound that could be radio-friendly or whatever, you know. So I just figured that the middle of the piano had the best sound, but what did I know? I was just a kid.
Mm. So you played on two of the Hearts records? Is that what you
Lonely
said?
Lonely Nights and, I forget now, it's been so long.
Was it the flip side called Ooh Wee Baby? Or?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. You played on those records for the Hearts, and that song, Lonely Nights, was a darn big hit on the R&B charts.
Yeah. Ironically, it was a big hit. It was a nominal hit. It was not a kind of a biggie, but it was enough to get us local gigs going around to Philadelphia, the Royal in Baltimore, the Howard in Washington, D.C., the Regal in Chicago, the Uptown in Philadelphia. Those were what they used to call the Chitlin' Circuit.
Mm-hmm.
had these little dances at the Savoy Ballroom, the Audubon Ballroom, and Rockland Palace. These are the places, the venues that had these R&B shows.
There's one thing in Lonely Nights that I wanted to get your opinion on, but whenever I play that on my show, I always refer to that piece that's the talking bridge. Or
that was Louise doing that.
Louise Harris. That was just an incredible part of that record.
You see what I'm saying? She wanted that part because Miss Sanders had this vision of a female ink spot. So the ink spots, you know, the bass usually did the talking. Well, come home, my baby, blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
So that's why Miss Sanders was so hung up on the ink spots. She wanted the girls to do that too. So I forget the recitation, but I know it ended with, "Please come home, you great big lump of sugar."
Yes, it does. And it's almost every time I play that, I remind the audience of that particular line because it just stood out so much in that record.
Right. I don't know who wrote that or added that in. I don't know. Probably Miss Sanders.
Tell me how you met Joe Rivers.
Joe Rivers is from Charleston, and my mother was from Charleston, South Carolina. So he found out I was playing piano. He wanted his idol was Dean Martin.
Hmm.
We were just friends, and we just started hanging out and, well, actually playing and singing. And my mother loved Joe because she didn't sing none of that raucous stuff. You know, he sang Dean Martin, early Frank Sinatra, something like that. So I played, and we did a lot of these church socials. So Miss Sanders one day heard it, Joe, and says, "Hey, bring him by. I didn't know he sang like that." And her daughter, Johnny, was singing too. She was never a part of the Hearts, but she figured, you know what? I'm going to give Johnny something to do. So I'm going to pair her with Joe, and I'm going to call them Johnny and Joe. That's how that was originated.
Well, I'll be darned.
Yeah.
And now, at that point in time, she had her own record company called J&S Records.
J&S Records, yeah.
How much involvement did you have on that record label?
None. I had nothing to do with that because I was a kid.
Mm.
I had nothing. All I did was play piano. That's all. I don't know anything about the administrative staff or whatever. I didn't know nothing. Plus, you didn't question Miss Sanders. You kept your mouth shut.
Right.
She had a name for me. She called me Maestro. And I thought that was the most complimentary thing. You know, I knew what it meant, but for her to call a somewhat piano player, it was okay, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It made me feel like I was accomplishing something.
Mm.
And it kind of introduced me to the music scene because, see, what happened was I knew every song that came out because back then the songs were so easy. They only had about 3 or 4 changes.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about it, though, is just it was the new beginning of this new music called R&B. My mother never relented. She just figured it would lead me down the wrong path, but it didn't. I liked being around girls, too, you know.
Well, that was certainly a benefit.
Right. That was my motivational technique.
Well, you know, getting back to Zell, she was kind of in a unique position of being an owner of a record label back in, 1956?
She was.
And being a woman owning a record company
right.
was pretty unusual back
it
then.
It was unusual, exactly. But she was very strict and stern, but she had a nice side to it, too. She had a vision about this label thing, and I was surprised by it because I didn't know that anybody could have a label like that, you know, but she did. She pulled it off.
J&S Records did have some very good releases and some that sold pretty well.
Yeah.
I'm thinking starting off, for instance, with Johnny and Joe when they did "I'll Be Spinning," which
that was
you
the
wrote.
First one, exactly.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And that did fairly well, and they were able to have an agreement with Chess Records. And,
uh-huh. They were the distributors.
Right.
Phil and Leonard Chess.
Although there's a lot of things to go through here, it certainly brings up another point where you weren't just playing the piano and doing a little singing here and there, but you were doing a lot of writing.
Yeah.
You seem to write a lot of songs that got a lot of good play for them.
Yeah, I did, because when you're writing something like that, I was always good at English. I never got no more than 20 in math, so I put my energies on English. And I was just writing songs of the day that something romantic, you know, poetry-type things, you know. My inspiration probably came from the books. I was the avid reader. I used to spend more time at the library than in the street. And don't forget, a lot of those songs back then was about love and this and that, you know, like flowers, springtime, blah, blah, blah. I was in that mode right then, too.
"Over the Mountain, Across the Sea." Tell me about writing that song.
Well, it was the Korean War, and it was really a love his love back home. I hope she's going to be there when I get back. Into each dark and starry night, over the mystery that seals so tight, over the mountain, a girl waits for me. That's what it was. It was a testament to the Korean soldier.
One thing that I also noticed, that once you had written those, they came out with a record first on JNS, you started then to get noticed, and you got a little bit of print on the label where it showed Rex Garvin and his orchestra, besides also showing the writing credits.
That was a misnomer. I had no orchestra. And Miss Anna just put that there. Which is good, you know. Who's supposed to know?
Well, that's true, but it looked good on the label, darn it.
Sure. If someone would have told me, a 15-year-old, to lead an orchestra, I would have had an acute case of diarrhea.
Well, I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
No. But she gave me that compliment as a thank you type of thing. That's all it was.
Well, you ended up writing quite a few songs for Johnny and Joe.
Yeah, My Baby's Gone On. My Baby's Gone On was the flip side of Over the Mountain, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct. So you continued certainly writing for Johnny and Joe. Were you also still playing piano while they were on JNS?
That I'm not sure. I did 85% of Johnny and Joe's work, but see, when I left, I don't know the history of it then. It wasn't a fallout, anything. We just moved on. Because I knew that Miss Sanders could not, for some odd reason, her business acumen were not good. And I saw the JNS not going anywhere because she had kind of did some bad deals, okay? And so I knew that the music was kind of changing and the kind of stuff we were doing was not up to snuff to me. I appreciate and love Miss Sanders for giving me that break, but I saw her grabbing any and everybody wanting to sing. You know, it was a conglomeration of just too much. I had moved on. I had gotten older, and I was into the different bands I was with before they might have played with. You know, a group of musicians would go to Jersey, you know, neighboring towns to play on the weekends. Newark, Connecticut, whatever. But I really didn't have time to rehearse anybody. Back then, when you rehearsed somebody from Miss Sanders, JNS, you kind of knew that if the song, I figured every song I wrote was a hit. You know, what does a kid know? When you saw that something was happening, and I would overhear conversations, because when Miss Sanders got on the phone and got mad at somebody, the whole house heard it. It scared me. I didn't want to, you know, I just figured, well, JNS is not going to, and I heard some rumblings about the chess fiasco and stuff like that, so I just figured I'd move on.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything that I was ungrateful for. I just, you know, moved on.
I know one of your first singles that showed you on the label as one of the singers would have been Marie and Rex, Marie Knight and yourself.
Oh, I Can't Sit Down.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a publisher that a lot of songwriters used to frequent. They used to frequent two addresses, 1619, which is the Brill Building, and 1650. I think Goldie Goldmark was in the 1650 one. And Marie Knight was with Sister Rosetta Tharpe for a while, a great gospel singer. And somehow or another, he wanted me to hook up with Marie Knight. I was naive. I said, okay, fine, you know, but I don't think Marie Knight dug my talent at all because I could, you know, she's a gospel singer. And here I am trying to invent a voice. She knew, you know, I just got a message, I can't sit down. Because that originally was a spiritual. And it was called Sit Down, I Can't Sit Down. I just got a message and I can't sit down. It was a gospel song. And, of course, a lot of that soul thing, that's how soul started, taking songs from the gospel and turning them around, a la Sam Cooke, Aretha Franklin, Solomon Burke, and the rest of them.
Right, right.
It all started in church. So I think Marie Knight figured, that's one of the mistakes of her life, hooking up with me. Because, I mean, she could sing. I mean, but I was just, you know, I was halfway decent looking back then. So I guess it didn't work. I knew that she didn't like my performance or like even being with me. But, you know, it's one of them things.
Yeah.
You know, you put people together that's not compatible. And I just chalk it up as experience.
So how did the group Rex Garvin and the Mighty Cravers originate?
There were three of us. There was Clayton Dunn on saxophone, Pete Holman on drums. I think Nick Hale started the group. It wasn't Rex Garvin, it was just the Mighty Cravers. Nick Hale was a drummer that lived uptown near St. Nicholas Avenue, I think. We wanted the three-piece group. I don't know how we met. I think probably jam session or something. And so we decided to take it a little further and just get a group together. Only three people. I played organ. It didn't need no bass by that time, because if you played right, it got the sound that a nightclub would like. Everybody was hiring organ players. Clayton Dunn and Nick got into little musical arguments because he wasn't the drummer that Clayton wanted. I mean, Nick was a friend of mine. See, back in the day, a band played jazz, Latin, R&B, romantic stuff, because people danced more then. And so Pete Holman could play anything. He could play the bossa nova, Latin, mambo, rumba, and he could play much better than Nick Hale. There was a choice between who would I go with, because Nick was a friend of mine, but I had to go with Clayton, because Clayton is the one that was getting the gigs.
Right.
Of course, me and Pete, he lived in New Rochelle, and he would sit in. I felt a comfortability I never felt with Nick. I felt with Pete, he could drive me to be a better musician. All musicians want that. So that's when that happened. So we became the Mighty Cravers in the late 50s, early 60s.
One of your first records, I should say, then, would have been Emulsified, which was quite a record for 1961.
Right.
Backed with Go Little Willie, a pretty good two-sider.
Right.
You wrote and recorded a really great song called Sockatoom JB.
Mm-hmm.
That one, you must have performed an awful lot, and definitely must have sold a few records on it.
We think so, but we don't know the exact count of it. Everybody thought it was a testimony to James Brown. It wasn't. It was J.B., James Bond.
Oh, James Bond.
Right, because if you notice, it says, dun-dun-dun-dun, from Russia with Love, dun-dun-dun, Dr. No. You know,
right.
It has all the James Brown titles in it. A guy named James Johnson, who owned the barbecue joint in the Bronx, he became like a mentor, and so he bankrolled a lot of that thing.
He must have been associated with a record label that you put it
on. No, he
called...
wasn't.
Oh, no.
He wasn't at all. He somehow figured that the record business he could sink his teeth into, which is a big mistake, because he was one of the nicest guys you ever wanted to meet. And his ribs, I want some now. He made a mustard sauce that was second to none. I mean, people used to come to the Bronx, I mean, firemen, cops, taxi drivers, any and everybody to get these ribs. And he'd give you a big plate of them. You know, he wasn't skimpy, you know, with it. He really wanted to push his son, Larry, into the business. But Larry couldn't sing. But he wanted, you know, the show business is almost addictive to a lot of people. They figure they can make some fast money on it, but it's not so.
Mm.
Even back then. You got to know what you're doing.
Tell me about the song, I Gotta Go Now.
It's about a dance thing. I want to get on the floor. I didn't know how well those things did, because I didn't think they did anything. I know Sockatoom JB did a nice thing, you know, but I don't know about I Gotta Go Now. I don't know.
From there, I see some stuff on the Tower label, Queen of the Go-Go, Sugar Baby.
Yeah, Give Me Your Love, Sugar Baby. She's the queen of... Yeah, that was me. Johnson bankrolled me for those things, you know. I wrote a lot of that stuff for the Mighty Cravers, but it didn't see the light of day. I guess bad promotion.
Well, is there anything that I may have skipped over that you're especially proud of or would like to mention?
I'm proud of just being a part of early R&B, and it was a minute part, but it was the music that I was brought up on. It made me turn from classical to just put classical down. I love classical, but I couldn't see, it was too stoic. And with classical, you got to play it note for note. There's no room for improvisation in classical. You got to play it note for note. So that wasn't for me. And I'm basically a lazy piano player. I'm not telling on myself, just the point about it. I like melodic stuff, and I like stuff with a beat. So I just found that R&B, just the R&B period was just my training ground. It's the music that I love. Because those songs were all about love, walking in the park, you know. It wasn't about negative things. It was just about, you listen to a lot of them songs, you're going to fall in love with somebody tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right.
You know. And it's just one of those things that was innocent. Every generation has their music, and I happen to be part of that music, which I love so dearly. I heard it on the radio, fell in love with it, and to see myself playing it at the Apollo was unreal. It was like dreams, many dreams coming true.
Rex, what are you doing these days?
I am working in office maintenance, and I love it.
Do you still play music, sing?
No, because there's so many musicians out here now, and because of things that I went through in New York and here, I just figured that, you know what, it's time to just be cool on that because things have changed. And I look at it this way, but people have asked me why. I said, look, this is the 21st century. Now and then, a couple of female singers may want me to accompany them once in a while, or a male singer. But it's not ongoing. It's a once in a while thing. And the ones that are my ilk, they know better than to try to get back in it because they feel the same way I do. You know, they're more settled. They don't want to travel or go on the road. And my mind could change, but I'm just saying how I feel about it at this particular moment. I don't see myself changing my opinion.
Well, Rex, thank you so much for joining me this evening at KVMR FM and sharing some of your life experiences in the music business starting back in the mid-1950s.
Mm-hmm. It's my pleasure.